Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles, and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 23rd of March 1924, some boys play football, a nation is reminded what the speed limit is, a man invents a new road layout, a magnate pleads poverty, and Japan prepares for world war. Not in this episode, for reasons of time, ignorance, or sloth, the Prime Minister addressed a group of journalists. Times correspondents have been complaining about a city skyscraper. Others have been complaining about the cost of becoming a doctor. And another has been complaining that the state is overcharging him for the use of the telephone. But first, the big stories this week. Churchill lost the Abbey by-election, see the 9th of March episode, to the Conservative candidate by 43 votes. That's three Westminster elections in a row he's lost. But he has won an election this week. This is from Tuesday the 18th. Mr. Winston Churchill was yesterday unanimously re-elected president of the Early Closing Association for the seventh time in succession. There's a bus and tram strike in London. The closing speeches are being made in the Beer Hall Putsch trial. In another trial in Germany, a chap called Martin Bormann has been jailed for manslaughter. A member of Sinn Féin took his seat in Westminster. Machine gun fire has been directed at British sailors in Ireland, killing one. In probably related news, the Irish Minister of Defence was forced to resign after two senior officers mutinied. A bomb factory has been discovered in Calcutta. The plan to build a naval base at Singapore has been dropped, for now. Fiume in the Adriatic has been annexed to Italy. And the Prince of Wales has fallen off his horse again. See the 10th of February episode. I was a bit surprised to see that bit about Fiume. Fiume, modern-day Rijeka, was a disputed territory at the end of the First World War. Italy had wanted it, but didn't get it. In response, poet and strategic bomber pilot Gabriele D'Annunzio and his Confederates occupied it for a year after the war, before being asked to leave. I was also surprised to read that a member of Sinn Féin had taken his seat in Parliament. They didn't before the Anglo-Irish Treaty, and they haven't in my lifetime, because they refused to recognise Westminster as a lawful authority. With the bus and tram strike in London underway, the chairman of United Electric Railways of London, and by extension much of the bus and tram network, Lord Ashfield, is at pains to point out, or at least claim, that there may not be as much money about as his employees would like to think. In the year 1923, the three tramway companies operating in Greater London, namely the Metropolitan Electric Tramways, the London United Tramways, and the South Metropolitan Electric Tramways, after meeting their fixed charges and providing a sum of £68,208 for track and other renewals, which was totally insufficient for the purpose, and £106,705, less than the sum set aside in the previous year, earned £19,682 upon a capital of £2,944,186, so that the return was less than 2/3 of 1%. Much the same sentiments were expressed in the 9th of March episode. Trams are going bust. I'd be curious to know what he means by capital. Does he mean capital outlay, assets, or market capitalisation? I'm guessing assets, track and trams, but if the company is not making money out of them, what are they really worth? In the first 2 months of 1924, these three tramway companies were in a worse position and actually failed to meet their fixed charges of £6,393, and had no funds available for the necessary track and other renewals at all. It is clear, therefore, that they cannot continue to operate on the present basis, much less meet any additional expense as must follow the acceptance of the present demands for increased wages. Still going bust, but there's worse. The earnings which are lost to the tramways are not gained by railways or omnibuses, as the results for the first 2 months of this year for the five companies associated together in the Common Fund show. These five companies, after meeting their fixed charges and making provision for reserves for renewals upon an unavoidably reduced scale, had, after 2 months working, a balance of £1,529, as compared with £197,193 for these 2 months a year ago. So there is practically no return whatever. I'm not surprised to hear that the Underground Railways are not making money. They didn't before the war, so why should they be after the war? But buses, that is a surprise, to the extent that I'm not sure that Ashfield is being entirely straight with us. By the way, while the transport company itself may not be making any money, the owners of the property next to the stations are coining it in. That is a long-standing oddity of transport economics. To increase fares appears an easy if unpopular way out at first sight, but it destroys traffic and is really useless. There is a very definite economic limit to fares, and, if anything, some existing fares are too high. I have in the past suggested that railways should be allowed to charge what they like, and been met with the objection that they double the fares overnight because, you know, people have to get to work. But maybe not. More transport. I saw this in Tuesday's edition. Mr. Graham Campbell at Bow Street Police Court yesterday mentioned that he was constantly hearing from motorists summoned before him that they were not aware that there was a speed limit still in force. Not only was there a speed limit of 20 miles an hour in the parks, but the same limit still applied all over the country, and it was important that motorists should be made aware of the fact. 20 miles an hour all over the country. Well, I can believe the 20 bit, something that seems to be coming back in urban areas, but all over the country, not just urban roads. I found this online. The national speed limit was raised again to 20 miles an hour in 1903 and stayed there until 1930. By that time it had become widely ignored and was difficult to enforce because cars were not required to have speedometers in those days. A driver accused of travelling at more than 20 miles an hour could simply claim that they thought they were going more slowly and had no reason to believe otherwise. Would that wash in front of a magistrate? If ignorance of the law is no defence, I doubt that ignorance of one's speed would be. Some offences are more obvious. This is from Friday the 21st. Ernest Albert Andrew, an omnibus driver of Oakley Street, Westminster Bridge Road, was fined £5 and ordered to pay £2 costs at the Marlborough Street Police Court yesterday for dangerous driving in Piccadilly on January the 26th, passing on the wrong side of a refuge and coming into collision with a taxicab. A refuge is what we would nowadays refer to as a traffic island. It's a frequent complaint that bus drivers at this time take all sorts of risks. How things have changed. A bus driver friend of mine a few years ago told me that as far as his employer was concerned, safety was, if not the first priority, that would be making money, then definitely the second. Crashes are expensive. And so is congestion. This is from a Mr. M.A. Blair from Monday. As one method of relieving traffic congestion, I would suggest that at every circus, no matter whether it consists of four or more meeting roads, all traffic should turn to the left and continue round until each vehicle reaches the road on its left that it desires to take. To facilitate this, the centre of the circus should be filled by a circular garden or enclosure, and the circus should be as large as it can be made. He's invented the roundabout, hasn't he? By the way, I had thought that circuses, Oxford Circus, Cambridge Circus, etc., were roundabouts. Apparently not. There was a debate on the army estimates, the army budget, in the House of Commons. One of the speakers was Brigadier General Seely, who, as well as being a general on the Western Front, had also been War Minister in the Liberal government before the war. This is from Tuesday the 18th. History showed that superior weapons and firepower had won the day. Yet, after all our experience, our army had a lower proportion of machine guns than any other. Although we were the richest country and ought to have the largest proportion of machine guns. On one occasion during the war, he had seen a battalion go over the top, not properly supported by firepower, and within a quarter of an hour, 25 of its 26 officers and all save 31 of its 1,000 men had been mown down and practically all of them killed. Seely became an appeaser in the 1930s. A mistake for sure, but I'm reluctant to condemn anyone for taking that view who's been through an experience like this. Having said that, things got better. Just before the great German attack in 1918, he obtained permission to make an attack on new principles, with the aid of enormously increased machine gun power. The attack was made on a frontage of nearly half a mile, and the intention was to penetrate the enemy's defence to a depth of 1 mile, and then to come straight back and kill or capture everybody in that section. The operation was a complete success. Every single man of the opposing garrison of about 800 Prussian guards was either killed or captured, including the officer commanding the garrison. The total British casualties were 6 men slightly and 1 man seriously wounded. Rather different from the usual narrative of men being mown down for nothing. So why was this attack so successful? In the critical 8 minutes before the attack, no fewer than 186,000 rounds of small arms ammunition were fired, and in the whole operation, which lasted an hour, over 1 million rounds were fired. He is describing what is known as a machine gun barrage. I've only ever seen this mentioned on one other occasion, Paddy Griffiths' Battle Tactics of the Western Front. From what I can glean, machine guns are fired from behind the attacking troops, at the enemy, and over the heads of the attackers. Presumably, as gravity brings the bullets back to Earth, they are still travelling fast enough to do damage. My problem with this is that if the barrage is maintained as the attackers close with the enemy's front line, surely they're going to get hit first. So is the barrage lifted before that happens, or is it aimed at a different target? Maybe the guns behind the enemy line. Artillery, not machine guns, were the big killer in the war. In Britain, we are passionate about our football, and have been for some time. Sometimes this ends up in court. This is from Saturday the 22nd. The hearing was concluded of this case, which raised the question whether the police had power to prevent boys from playing football in a deserted street. The action was brought by Edward Johnson, aged 16, who sued, by his father, against Police Constable George Waters, stationed at King David Lane East, for damages for assault and personal injuries. A number of boys assembled in Narrow Street, this is in Limehouse, close to the docks, with a football, which was hired at the rate of 2 pence a game. In the centre of the street was an open space free from all traffic, and this was the only place in which children could play in that part of London. The defendant and another police constable, both of them in plain clothes, appeared on the scene. The boys ran away, and it was said that the plaintiff, in trying to evade the defendant, slipped and fell, and that the constable, falling on him, broke the boy's leg. His Lordship: is there some bylaw in this part of the world which prohibits the playing of football in Narrow Street? Mr. Sergeant Sullivan. I'd love to know if the sergeant bit is a name or a title. Sullivan, by the way, is the plaintiff's counsel. Sergeant Sullivan said that he knew of none. Of course, any game was prohibited which was a danger or nuisance to passers-by. But if there were no passers-by, he knew of no law to prevent it. If so, it rather undermines the policeman's case. His Lordship, in summing up, said that the jury were not called on to express an opinion of the question whether it was desirable for small boys to play football in more or less deserted streets on Sunday mornings. The jury, after about an hour's deliberation, that's quite long for those days, returned a verdict for the plaintiff and awarded him £20, 5 shillings damages. Oh, well, 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 I was not expecting that. I was told that in those days the courts always took the side of the police, especially against the less well-off, but not on this occasion. As mentioned earlier, this week the government announced that it would not be pursuing plans to build a naval base at Singapore. The purpose of the base would be to counter the threat from Japan by allowing Britain to operate battleships in the Indian Ocean. They haven't had to before now. This has inspired a letter from Geoffrey Drage, a conservative intellectual who usually comments on welfare policy. This is from Wednesday the 19th. The British Empire is first and foremost an Asiatic empire. I've heard it said that the British Empire was an Indian Ocean empire. I think that's a better description. Essentially, the British took anywhere they could reach by sea and which lacked the ability to counter them militarily. Within the last half century, a new power has arisen, he means Japan, which has succeeded in obtaining a complete control of the Western Pacific and now aims at the mastery of the islands in that area and the continent adjacent thereto. The Russo-Japanese War broke the spell of white invincibility, and the Great War seriously impaired European prestige in the Far East. Marquis Okuma, afterwards Prime Minister in 1915, wrote in 1907 as follows. Being oppressed by the Europeans, the 300 millions of Indians are looking for Japanese protection. Are they really? Japanese ought to go to India. Before the war, Mr. Hara, who succeeded Okuma as Prime Minister, preached as a journalist the doctrine of Asia for the Asiatics and wrote of the white peril as opposed to the yellow peril. Hong Kongers may see things differently. Today her army consists of 250,000 men with the colours and a fully trained reserve of 618,000. But there is no secrecy at all in the fact that recent reforms in organisation are intended to give Japan in the year 1930 a fully trained army of 4.5 million, recruited entirely from her sons. Longford, page 235. That is enormous. Bigger, I believe, than either the French or German armies at the outset of the First World War. As to the Navy, the Washington Conference, this was the Naval Arms Limitation Treaty signed in 1922, in the words of a competent authority, Golovin, has not only prevented the possibility of war, it has not even stopped the preparations for war. Half the Japanese national budget is expended on the Army and Navy, while the naval budget is twice that of the Army. The Army and the Navy are not under the control of the Japanese Parliament, but under that of the Emperor. Oh, really? That puts a rather different complexion on Hirohito's role in the war. The structure is also rather reminiscent of Germany before the First World War. In addition, it must be recollected that Japan favours preventive wars, which might include attacking an enemy's fleet without warning, for instance, and that as the result of her conflicts with China and Russia and the Great War, Japan sees in war a source of economic prosperity. The Japanese islands have, roughly speaking, a population of 56 million. The profits of the Great War went to the exchequer and the capitalists. The masses are impoverished. Markets have been lost, to a large extent due to trade barriers. Hence, more than ever, Japan casts covetous eyes on China. Japan needs raw materials apart from foodstuffs. She requires cotton, oil, coal, and above all, iron, the want of which has been called the Achilles tendon, not Achilles heel, of her military power. To obtain these, she is certain to tighten her grasp on China. As to the Philippines, a prominent American naval officer has written, "The Philippines are there for Japan whenever she likes to take them, and nothing can prevent her from seizing them whenever she feels inclined to do so." The same may be said of the Dutch East Indies, and so it proved. Our possessions come next, and we have to recognise that in Singapore, Borneo and Hong Kong, and the rest, we are face to face with a proud, patriotic, warlike, seafaring nation, animated by perfectly legitimate ambitions. Her demand for racial equality was, to her indignation, rejected at Versailles, so she has set about getting it, and other things, her own way. She has a moral code, Bushido, as lofty as our own. It's rare to see moral and Bushido in the same sentence. My understanding is that it was Bushido that led to the Japanese massacring civilians, mistreating prisoners of war, and committing suicide when things went wrong. Her government is in the hands of a determined militarist oligarchy. In 1930, Japan will be ready. if not before. We are as we were in 1908. Only Japan is far more clever than Germany. Peace can be maintained if it is perfectly clear what our policy is in the Far East and that we mean to stand by it. Otherwise, as in the case of the Crimean War, the Boer War, and the Great War, we shall drift into war because the pacifists will once more be taken at their own valuation as qualified to speak for Great Britain. The naval base at Singapore is a test of our resolution. Prophetic words. It was in 1931 that Japan invaded Manchuria, beginning a series of wars which ended with the dropping of the two atomic bombs. Sadly, of course, the base at Singapore, which, spoiler alert, will be built, neither deterred Japan nor proved much use in fighting her. It, along with the whole of Malaya, was captured in 1942. But that has got to be the clearest explanation I have ever read as to why Japan went to war in the Pacific. Up to now, it's been explained as a series of apparently unconnected events. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.